podcast listeners, Michael Shelley here. Jonathan King is our guest today. He is as irrepressible a personality as I have ever interviewed, period. And he goes on at length about some things, but he's quite entertaining. I think you will enjoy this. Check out WFMU.org/Michael for the list of upcoming guests. I also interviewed, by the way, today, Larry Tamblyn of the Standells, but both interviews were just too long for one podcast, so we're going to break that up. You'll hear Larry's interview next week. That's coming. Check out now my interview with Jonathan King.
Mouth full of chocolate, covered cream, arms that can only lift a spoon. Everyone's gone to the moon. Everyone's gone to the moon. Everyone's gone to the moon.
Indeed. That is really just a number one hit record from Jonathan King, and he joins us on the telephone. He is a disc jockey, a writer, one of UK's first independent producers, a record label head, a recording artist under many different names, and a guy who's done a million different things. Good morning, Jonathan King, and welcome to WFMU. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. I'm fine. It's afternoon here in Great Britain.
Certainly it is. Certainly it is. Sorry for your World Cup loss, first off.
I don't think we even bothered to enter this year. We did so badly.
Yeah.
But it's all been quite fun, so I'm actually reasonably glued to it, and I'm rooting for Germany, I have to say.
Fair enough. That song is from 1965, sold 4.5 million copies. You are 21 years old, a college student at the time. How did you find your way into the entertainment business?
Well, yes, I was actually 20. I wasn't 21 until that December in 1965. And I was very lucky in a way. I was battling away trying to get in and getting nowhere. And then one wonderful man, a man called Tony Hall, who was a disc jockey but also was head of promotion at Decca Records, thought I sounded interesting and allowed me to come and visit him. And he encouraged new young talent. And the three people he was encouraging were myself, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, all of whom were about the same age, all of whom were either at school or had just left school and started in college. And he basically eventually encouraged us enough that we ended up with record deals, and I ended up recording that, and as you said, it did just under 5 million copies.
Not bad. I mean, it seems to be that, was it a song that came out in the summertime?
Yes, it was. Essentially, it came out in the summer all over the world and was a big summer hit.
Yeah, it seems like quite a perfect soundtrack for summer. One of the things I haven't been able to read about you is, do you play the guitar, the keyboards? Do you play an instrument? Are you trained in that way?
Not in any way. I play very, very three or four chords on an acoustic guitar, which only gives me enough to actually record demos of songs. I then sit down with my arrangers and actually sing them all the different parts that the musicians should be playing, and then go into the studio with the musicians and work it from there.
So it's really just all about melody. I mean, would you say that's sort of the first key to having a great hit pop song?
It is for me, although I have to say my hits actually also got a lot of assistance from the lyrics.
Yeah, well, good lyrics, great melody, great players. What else do you need? So you quickly sort of started to work producing other folks, Hedgehopper's Anonymous and It's Good News Week, another giant hit for you, and also a small hit in America, and Everything Gone to the Moon, I think number 17 in America, which is not bad at all. As the 60s are changing, what was the situation in the UK? I mean, I imagine that finally the old guard was saying, you know, perhaps this rock and roll Beatles thing isn't a flash in the pan, and I'm imagining they're running around crazy trying to save their jobs. Is that what was happening?
To a degree, but actually they were mainly encouraging us young kids, and it was thanks to the Beatles happening everywhere. If the Beatles hadn't broken America, then I don't think a lot of the rest of us would have happened. Funnily enough, My Everyone's Gone to the Moon was number one in virtually every city in every state, but it took quite a long time to move from one side of America to the other. So I think nationally, it only got into the teens, but in fact, it was number one on almost every radio station. Quite interesting. Rather sadly, as you probably know, recently the great DJ Casey Kasem passed away. And I remember he was DJing a big syndicated American chart show at the time, which was absolutely massive in the States on radio. And at number one was a cover of one of my songs, which was a song called Hooked on a Feeling, that had been covered by a Swedish group identically to my version called Blue Swede. And Casey reached number one in the charts and said, well, at number one is Blue Swede with Hooked on a Feeling, but they've stolen the entire arrangement from Jonathan King, so I'm playing his original version. And he played it because I'd started mine Ooka Jugga, Ooka Ooka, which is what they copied. I rather appreciated that. There were some certain great DJs like Casey Kasem who've been around a while, but they were really very supportive of us youngsters.
We opened the show this morning with your version of Hooked on a Feeling, which is, yeah, a perfect pop song in my estimation. So you leave university and you get your own television show, I'm Jonathan King. And if folks go onto YouTube, they can see this quite 1960s. You're sort of lying around on pillows wearing a very 60s wardrobe and interviewing people in this way that it just doesn't happen anymore. It was very free and open and wild in a way I can't imagine the little old ladies of the UK were happy about that.
No, funnily enough, they did. It was rather nice in those days, and it was something which hasn't happened since. I mean, it has, but it's been changing. With people going in for specialist tastes and specialist areas of entertainment, especially in music now, as you well know, people either like rap or country or whatever, and they tend not to like anything else outside that genre. And in those days, we really specialised in crossover stuff that appealed to everybody. And it was the same with things like television and radio as it was with music, in that we found if it was successful and popular, it tended to appeal to everybody, from little old ladies and grandparents down to small children. But if people liked a song or a record or a TV show or a film or a book, everybody liked it. And I rather like that kind of thing. These days, it tends to be sort of horses for courses, which I don't appreciate so much.
Yeah, I completely agree. We've talked about this in many different contexts on the show. What I sort of call the Ed Sullivan effect, where there was something for the entire family, and everyone could sit through the other person's favorites, but everyone enjoyed everything, and it was not a narrow-casted. You know, now you have a whole channel just devoted, as opposed to a show that, you know, tried to please everyone but with quality stuff, not with watered down stuff. So, okay, back to the story. So you're producing different acts, you're having hits as yourself, you're also working as a talent spotter, finding different bands like Genesis, who you signed up, and you're working on television, between, I believe, 1965 and 1975, you've got how many singles in the top 40, which you are a performer, sometimes under different names, but how many singles that you're a performer or a producer on in that 10-year span would you guess?
I was very lucky. I had loads of different ones. Yes, as you said, I used to specialize in putting records out that I was singing on under other names and had many hits of that type. But yes, I was essentially a producer. Funnily enough, this whole thing of me being a talent spotter is wrong. One of the disadvantages of the new internet world, in that anybody can write anything,
yes,
is you get things like Wikipedia, which are Chinese whispers, and get all the details slightly wrong. And I never really was a talent spotter. I was always an independent producer. And in that capacity, I did find a lot of other people's talents. such as I went back to my old school, Charterhouse, which was a public school. In America, you call them private schools or prep schools. And there were these young lads making music without a name. They were the school band, but they had a most wonderful vocalist singing, who was Peter Gabriel. And I thought they were superb, so I produced them, gave them the name Genesis, and they went on to do very good things. And in fact, I've been doing loads of interviews recently with people who were very interested in the early days of Genesis and the discovery of them and their first album and their first few tracks and how they developed.
Yeah, what's amazing is you go from working on the first Genesis record a couple years later to working on the very first Bay City Rollers single, Keep On Dancing, which we heard earlier in the show. It's sort of just applying your pop sensibility to whatever came along. Tell me about working with that band. Did you have some idea that they were going to become a cultural phenomenon?
The Bay City Rollers?
Yeah.
I actually didn't think they would, and they weren't that great, so much so that they didn't play or sing on the record. At least the lead singer did sing the lead, but I actually sang the 13 backing vocals in different voices and used only session men to play on it, because they were nice, bright, young kids who the fans really loved in the way that they love One Direction these days, because they looked right, but they didn't actually have much musical talent. In fact, I have to say they didn't have as much talent as One Direction have. I just put the record together. I put it together thinking they were going to be so popular that they would explode and I'd be able to put records together that weren't that good and wouldn't normally have sold but would sell on the image. That's the great advantage of having a teen band like that. You don't have to make hits every time to still sell lots of records, because the little kids will buy the music because they like the image of the artist. Unfortunately, even though Keep On Dancing was huge, top 10, and sold very well in England, then the next ones I produced didn't sell at all. And after a year or two, I gave up on them. And it wasn't for a couple of years that they actually then had another producer, or that another producers, Bill Martin and Phil Coulter, who were good friends of mine. And they came up with another track called something like Saturday Night, which broke, and it did eventually make them into big stars that they were meant to be. I was always rather ahead of my time. I remember that time, one of my dear friends is a man called Clive Davis, who was the head of Arista. And he picked up this band. They were produced for Arista, who incidentally have never paid me my producer royalties, but that's another story. And he and I were having breakfast one day in New York, because I had an apartment in New York as well as my home in London, and he said to me, "Jonathan, do you think the Bay City Rollers could ever happen in America?" And I replied, "Well, Clive, I've got to tell you, my head says no, not in a million years, but my heart says yes, the time is right for them." And he said, "Oh, I think I'll go with your heart, Jonathan." Promoted the band, and they exploded.
Yeah. A train spotting question. Who's playing the drums on Keep On Dancing?
I'm not sure. It may well have been Clem Cattini. I had lunch with Clem the other day. He was one of the great session musicians of all time and played drums on the Tornadoes records. You remember Telstar and others?
Sure, we've had
and
Clem.
He was very sweet. We had a lovely lunch, and he said, "Jonathan, I have to tell you, during the 70s, all our session musicians thought you were the best record producer in the world." And I have to say, I said to him, "I'm very flattered, Clem, but you must be out of your mind." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I've got to tell you, even though I love record producing and did it as well as I could, I wasn't nearly as good as many others. And Telstar was produced by somebody who, along with Phil Spector, is, I think, perhaps the greatest record producer of all time, Joe Meek." And I said, "Clem, how you could have played with me and played with Joe Meek and thought I was in the same class as Joe Meek, who's 10 times greater as a record producer than I was, I don't know. But I did appreciate his support."
Yeah, we've had Clem on the show here before. I love hearing the stories about session guys. So, I mean, just to set the stage, a lot of these records that you made were made in these sort of very typical, whatever they were, 3-hour sessions where the session guys would come in, see the charts, and just cut 2 or 3 songs and take their 18 pounds or whatever and leave. Is that basically how your thing was done?
Absolutely, especially in my case. I knew when I was going into the studio exactly how the records should sound when they came out of the studio. So I went in with Miss Escher musicians. We did a three-hour session in the morning with just the rhythm team. Then they went out, got their money and left, and then in came the strings and the brass and all that lot, and I laid them down. Then in would come the backing singers, and I'd laid them down. Then I'd go down and put on my vocal, or bring in the singers and vocalists to do their part. And then for the rest of the night, I'd mix usually the four tracks, and I think my biggest success was three out of the four were top three singles in one session.
Not a bad day's work.
I remember one session in particular, funnily enough, the session that produced Hooked on a Feeling, Ooga Chugga Ooga Ooga, and my bass player on the session was Herbie Flowers. And Herbie was so knocked out by hearing the Ooga Chugga, which I was doing in the studio so that they could understand how it was eventually going to sound, because I wanted that as like a reggae rhythm, but on a male voice rather than on the usual guitar or whatever. Herbie then refused to leave, and he said he insisted on staying up in the control room all the way through the rest of the night, the day and the night, until I'd finally mixed it, because he thought it was such a brilliant idea and he wanted to hear the finished record.
Uh-huh. Of course, he went on to play, I think, Walk on the Wild Side, the Lou Reed bass line that is so famous. That's such a different way of now people just make a record in their basement or anywhere, and the sort of idea of these session guys who were such experts, it's a mixed bag to sort of move on, but that's the way it was then. Tell me, we talked about Hooked on a Feeling, tell me about Let It All Hang Out, which we heard earlier in the show from 1970. I mean, I think that, you know, that the original record, the Hombres, I think it's on the Verve label. I have that album. How did you hear it and have the idea that this would make an appropriate cover for Jonathan King?
I was always a huge fan of pop music in America. And as I said earlier about Phil Spector, who is a god, who I'm still in touch with. I write him the odd letter. He's not at liberty at the moment, but I think he was a truly great producer. I was a huge fan of Bob Crewe, who I also got very close friends with. I was a huge fan of Steve Barry, who's a producer not generally known much, but he produced The Mamas and the Papas, The Grassroots, Dizzy by Tommy Rowe, those called A Sugar Sugar by the Archies, and I thought he was a terrific producer. A lot of really great producers. I did always regard myself as a record producer above everything else, and I was a big fan of the record, so I used to listen to a lot of them and enjoy them, but many of them did not become British hits, the American tracks, and when they came out and sank without trace, I went, oh, this is crazy, it should be a hit, and recorded it myself. When Let It All Hang Out, I tried to get a similar kind of feel to the original, but probably the one that really worked was It's the Same Old Song, which I couldn't believe was not a hit for the Four Tops, because it was such a brilliant record, and I was so annoyed by the fact that it hadn't been a hit that I wanted to do my own version, so I did my own quite different version of It's the Same Old Song and put it out under the name The Weathermen, a name that was given to me by my dear friend Phil Oakes, another great and underrated writer and performer in America in the 60s. And that was a very big hit in Britain. Another one I did a similar thing was a song called It Only Takes a Minute. There was a huge hit for Tavares, written, funnily enough, by a duo, one of whom was British. And it had died around the rest of the world. And I thought, this is crazy. It's such a great song. So I did it completely different, with a high falsetto vocal and a single solo violin and a Moog bass sound, and that turned into a huge hit for me as well under the name 100 Ton and a Feather.
Yeah, I think that was a number nine hit. Yeah, you covered Sugar Sugar as a band named Saccharin. There's all these different, you know, you picked great songs and covered them and had all these different band names, and like you said, some of them really are just different singers, but it's still your thing. Songs like The Piglets and Johnny Reggae and
that was the other one on the session that Herbie Flowers insisted on staying for.
He couldn't wait to see how it would turn out. Tell me about the Angelettes. We heard that song earlier, Don't Let Him Touch You. I think, for me, that is maybe my favorite of your outside productions. I mean, an amazing song that you wrote, and then just a great great arrangement and a great production. Just what a great record that is.
Yes, I heard you playing that, and I was really delighted because I was so proud of that record. Never a hit, sadly, although it did turn into a small hit, and there was a big story behind that. They went on Top of the Pops, our TV show, and the sound went, and so it was transmitted with not a single note of sound until it came back at the end. And rumours had it that the BBC deliberately did that because they had a nervous feeling about the message that was coming through. I think that, I don't think they quite understood that it was rather tongue-in-cheek from me. But and funny enough, the Angelettes, those who are still alive, a couple of them have since died, but the ones who are still alive have got back in touch with me and are very dear friends. They're all ladies like me now in their 60s, and we're all back in touch and see each other quite frequently. But I was very proud of that record. I have to say, again, that record, although that record is completely original in every way, but it was completely a homage to another one of my great favourite American record producers, sadly, who's since recently died, Shadow Morton, who was, sadly, he was from your neck of the woods up there in New Jersey, and he was a great, he was one of the great brill-building super writers. He was friends with another dear friend of mine, Ellie Greenwich, in whose building I got my apartment in New York and lived for 30 years. And those huge talents, you know, Jeff Barry, Carole King, all that era of writers in New York, which to me was the most extraordinary, stunning talent era. Gene Pitney and people came out of it as well. But Shadow Morton, who did all the Shangri-La's records, and the, you know, some of those wonderful ones like Remember Walking in the Sand and Leader of the Pack, and that wonderful one of I Can Never Go Home Anymore, which I think is my favourite of his, which was sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek, but done so brilliantly well. And that the Angelettes, Don't Let Him Touch You, was completely and totally me saying, OK, Shadow Morton, you're a genius. Let me see if I can do something that's similar.
Yeah, well, it's definitely in that girl New York girl group sort of vein, but it succeeds just on so many levels. That's one of my favorites. You started your own label, UK Records, put out a bunch of hits by a bunch of folks, 10cc included. Who did you discover them, or what's the what is the exact connection?
I did indeed, yes, not only discover them and gave them their name. I'd been friendly with them in the old days when they were, or two of them, were in the Mindbenders with Wayne Fontana in the 60s. And we'd all done similar shows together on Top of the Pops and all the rest of it. And when I started my label, Eric Stewart, who was one of the Mindbenders, had produced this record called Neanderthal Man by Hot Legs, which I thought was superb. And it was a big hit, but that was they disappeared without trace. And I called Eric up and said, look, I love the stuff you're doing. Have you got anything I'd like? And he said, well, we got this one song that every record label has turned down, but we love it. And I said, what is it? He said, it's called Donna. I'll send it to you. And these were in the days before emails and such downloadings. Sent it to me in the post. I listened to it. Immediately thought it was a huge smash hit. Said, right, I'll give you your name. I came up with a name because I had a dream that night that the number one album and single on the Billboard Hot 100 was by a group called 10cc, and I thought, what a great name. So I woke up the next morning, called them and said, right, I've given you your new name. And I sort of became the fifth member of 10cc, and then between us we started putting all these things together, some of which I think are the great records of all time. Wall Street Shuffle, which was 30 years ahead of its time and has sort of become the theme of all the banking insanity that's gone on in the last 5 or 6 years. Others like Headline Hustler, which is all about the strange things that have been going on in the media here in Britain, you know, with phone tapping and hacking and all that kind of stuff. And I still think they're one of the great bands of all time. I'm very proud to have been associated with them. Funnily enough, they're coming up for some sort of anniversary, as Genesis are, and I've been doing a load of interviews with people in the British media about the early days, how they were discovered, how we built them. And one of the journalists recently who interviewed me said, it's interesting because he really puts them on a par with Queen. They both started around the same time. They were both equally big at the same time. They both had their hugest hits. Queen had Bohemian Rhapsody and we had I'm Not In Love with 10cc. But then Queen exploded and went even bigger, and that's when 10cc started to sort of fizzle out a bit. And of course the sad thing was they then left me and went to a very big record label for an awful lot of money, but the result was I wasn't there and I wasn't part of it anymore, and they sort of then fizzled out.
Yeah, let's talk about being a pop star in the UK. You've got a website called kingofhits.co.uk, and it's an endless website that folks can browse at their leisure at. And from looking at different clips, sort of scrapbook pieces from newspapers, it seems like being a pop star in the UK in the 1960s, very different from being a pop star in the US in the 1960s. There's just sort of the gossip mill and just articles and innuendo and all sorts of reportage about nothing, basically, seems to have followed you through your career. Is that right?
Yes, and it's absolutely true. We hit that huge level. It sort of happened to a degree as well in the States, I remember. I had that one first hit that was huge, and there were a lot of interest in it. But no, the British have always sort of put pop stars in those days and that era, at least the 60s, 70s and 80s, we were the sort of royalty of entertainment in Britain, along with footballers, much as in America it was much more baseball players and American football players who became legends, you know, people like Joe Namath and all that sort of thing, became real huge names and people who everybody knew and everybody talked about Mickey Mantle and that kind of thing. Those sort of sporting heroes in the 60s and 70s, the pop stars in Britain really became the same. I think, again, thanks to the Beatles and other groups like, obviously, the Stones because of Mick Jagger, and so many stars came forward. And that went on, with a lot of them coming then out of America, with people like Michael Jackson and so on. But I think the end of those huge stars was probably in the 90s, when you had people like Madonna and Prince and so on. And when they all started fading out, I think they've never been replaced. So the new lot of big music stars or entertainment stars, even film stars, have never been quite up to that quality of standard. One of the huge film stars, who I think was a great superstar, who actually covered Everyone's Gone to the Moon, and she did her version, was Marlene Dietrich. And all the young people who may be listening to you at the moment probably don't even know who she is. But she was perhaps the last, I think, really enormous worldwide star, along with people like Liz Taylor and so on, Mae West, that actually was a massive star. Ever since the 90s, the stars have been smaller, but then that's what Gloria Swanson said in Sunset Boulevard.
So between, you know, your debut in 65 and by 1980, I don't know exactly, but I'm going to the figure 75 top 40 UK chart singles had something to do with you. You're singing them, you're producing them, you're writing them. It's a lot of records, and it seems like that's right about the time when you decided to sort of make a move and get more into television and writing and other things, and moving to the United States. Was there a change in the wind, or what led you to do that?
Well, there's two things. Yes, you're quite right. The world was changing. We just touched on 10cc leaving me and going to a big record company. And that really shattered my illusions, and actually in human beings, in humanity. Because we had a firm contract and everything had been agreed and all that. And I'd said to them, they understood they weren't going to make much money out of their deal with me. And neither was I for the first two or three years, because it costs a lot of money to break an act. And that my big profits were going to come in years 4 and 5 of the contract, by which time I'd hoped to have broken them by spending a fortune, and would then be making a fortune. At the end of the 5-year deal, they would then be free to renegotiate or go to another major label or whatever. When they then broke contract in their 3rd year, as I was breaking even with them, so the huge monies then came from a record label, and I didn't make that much, I thought, you know what, this is a mug's game. Every time you try and break and work an artist or an act or a band or a singer or so on, the moment they get big, they're going to go, no, we don't like the deal we had with you when we had no money and we couldn't afford to do anything. Now we're stars and we're making lots of money, we're going to go somewhere else. So I thought, it's really not worth staying in that. I wanted to write a book, my first novel. I had my apartment in New York by then. I'd wound the record label down. I loved New York, still do, and I loved going to baseball games. I was a massive Mets and Yankees fan and went to any baseball game I could go to, still adore them, and I thought I'll go and give it a chance. And I went over to New York, started doing radio bits for the BBC and for Top of the Pops and various things, you know, about America, from America. Went on a local, there were the general elections coming up in America, and I think it was Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter and people like that. I went on the radio to talk about the British attitude to the American politicians. One of the radio stations I went on, WMCA in New York, where, funnily enough, I'd been number one on the station 15 years earlier with Everyone's Gone to the Moon, loved me chatting, asked me if I would take over a show, the radio show that was done in the mornings by Sally Jesse Raphael, who's gone on to be a big TV star, and they fired her. You know how ruthless radio can be. Not your station, I'm sure, Michael. Yeah. And they fired her, took me on. She did it very well. She was a great lady. I'm very fond of her. And took it extremely well and promoted me and told all her listeners to stick with me and all that. A real professional, knew what she was doing. And I took that over and did that for a year or so, got massive ratings. Was off the big guy in the mornings was a guy called Don Imus, who did the morning show, and then almost everybody switched over to me for the like 10 to 12 or 10 to 1 slot. And in fact, when I left the station, because I only wanted to do it for a year, I loved doing it for a year. It was talk radio mainly, so I was doing a lot of chat and phone-ins. I was offered my program director at WMCA was a guy called Mark Mason, and he'd gone over to WNBC, and he wanted me to take over the afternoon slot. So they had Don Imus in the morning, and then me doing the drive time in the afternoon shows. And they offered me an absolute fortune, but I didn't want to do it because, as I said, I'd done a year of being a radio DJ. I'd loved doing it. I loved the station. It was an independently, privately owned station by Ellen Strauss and her husband, Peter. And they were really nice people, and I really thoroughly enjoyed myself on the station. Loved the communication I had with people who lived in the area there. But a year was enough. And so Mark Mason, finally, after I turned out an absolute fortune, decided to take on a guy who was doing overnights on a little station down in Washington who nobody'd ever heard of, but Mark Mason thought he might be almost as good as me, though probably not as good, and gave him the job instead, Howard Stern.
Yeah. Of course. Amazing. You talked about Clive Davis never paying, or not Clive Davis personally, but Arista never paying you your Bay City Rollers royalty. When you're a producer and when you're a guy who's recorded on so many different labels, what percentage of labels treated you fairly? Do you think you've gotten all your money from?
Oh, yes, I never had any problem because normally I was an independent producer who not only paid for the sessions but continued to own the rights to all the records, which I still have, and therefore I licensed them to the labels, and they couldn't avoid paying me that very hefty amount that I demanded in return. And it was only for a certain period of time, usually 3 years, 5 years or whatever, then the rights reverted to me, and we kept our eye very much on top of them. But the Rollers thing was slightly different because they had already signed to Arista, so as a result they just employed me as a producer on a percentage, quite a decent, I think 4 or 5% royalty I was earning, and they paid for the session, so as a result I was just meant to be getting a royalty like artists got a royalty. And in those days Arista was a very new label. Clive had been thrown out of CBS or Sony, as they then became, and had been fired for, I think, paying for a bar mitzvah for his son or something out of company monies. Some kind of mini scandal took place.
Yeah, his son's bar mitzvah,
Clive,
yeah.
Clive was a brilliant record man, and still is, I'm here to say, and still remains one of my dearest friends, started his own label up, which, funnily enough, was only halfway down the block on 57th Street, where I lived. It was actually Bell Records at the time, and he bought it up and then changed the name to Arista. So it was Bell when they bought it, and it was a smallish label, you know. I think it was owned by Columbia Screen Gems, the film people, and I think he part-owned it and all that. So it was just a slightly different setup. But no, I've never been paid a penny for it.
But, okay, so usually if somebody uses one of these songs we've played, the Jonathan King songs, then you're going to profit from that, because you're actually still owning the masters of all of these things.
Absolutely so, and I've just had two absolutely enormous checks in. One for one of the other things I produced, which was the original soundtrack for a show that nobody wanted to know about that I thought was brilliant, called The Rocky Horror Show. And I still, of course, since I produced it, own all the total rights for the original soundtrack and everything. And that sells very well, and I still get large checks for that one. And the other things, of course, are things like Genesis and 10C, which I own all the rights for and constantly get paid large amounts. And the last thing is something called PPL, which is a lot of radio stations in America don't pay it, but all the satellite ones do. And I get a lot of money from PPL, which is my tracks being played. And sometimes it's rather surprising. And I just got a check, which was for, I've tried to convert it into dollars, it was for the last 3 months, and it was something like $30,000 to $40,000. And it was simply for my tracks. And I looked at the PPL statement, and it was mainly radio stations in Belgium and Finland and China, for some reason, that had been playing lots of my old tracks and my old songs. And as you know, with your station, you've just played some of my music. A few pence each time comes back to me. I'm quite often the writer and the publisher, as well as the singer and performer and the record producer, and therefore the rights owners. So checks do keep arriving from all those tired old hits. So I hope your listeners appreciated them.
I think they do. What records do you, if you're driving to the supermarket, what do you listen to in your car?
I'm getting a little old, so I tend to listen to old stuff. There's a new track. Once or twice a year, I hear a new track, and I go, oh, my God, that is absolutely brilliant. And there's a new track in 2014, and if you haven't heard it or played it, I would urge you and beg you to get hold of a copy and play it. And it's a track called Rather Be by a group called Clean Bandit, right? So check out, you'll find it on YouTube, check out Clean Bandit and Rather Be, and it is absolutely so Jonathan King, you wouldn't believe it. All the way through, I'm going, they've done exactly what I would have done. That's a masterpiece. I looked up YouTube this morning. I was playing it to a friend of mine who hadn't heard it, and I looked up the views on YouTube, and they've just passed 82 million views on YouTube. So I think you'll find that's going to be a big hit. It's come out in the States. I think it made 1 week to number 100 on the Billboard Top 100 and dropped out. It should be a huge hit.
I haven't heard of it. I'll check it out today. It's quite interesting. All right, here's what I've got. 1966, Just Like a Woman. One of my favorite Jonathan King cuts. Jonathan King is our guest. Kingofhits.co.uk is his website. Tell me about the making of this song. And I assume you cut a bunch of Bob Dylan songs, so I assume you have some genuine love for his stuff.
Yes, absolutely adore him. One of my great heroes and a great, great, great songwriter. Yes, I love that song. I'm glad you seem to have a similar taste to me in my tracks, I'm glad to say, Michael, because I adore that, and I adore the Angelettes, and a few others of mine I really love, including, I'm here to say, there I am standing waiting for my car at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel in Los Angeles way back in the 70s, and a friend of mine comes strolling up to me who is Mick Jagger, who you may have heard of. He's a singer with a minor band called the Rolling Stones and has written a couple of hits, and he said to me, Jonathan, I've got to tell you, your version of Satisfaction is the best version of that song of anybody's, apart from the Rolling Stones, he said, of course. Yeah. And I'm very, very delighted he said that, and I have to say I do agree with him. I think my version of that song was terrific. But, yes, Just Like a Woman, I heard the original Bob Dylan demo, and I love Bob Dylan songs, especially some of the rather more obscure ones. If you haven't heard it, you must check out one called Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window, which is not a generally known Dylan song. It's superb. And Just Like a Woman was one of those. I thought, I just adore that song. And I wanted to do my own version. And that was when I was still being produced by Ken Jones and Joe Roncaroni, who were my producers, who'd done Everyone's Gone to the Moon. Really terrific producers. They produced a band you may have heard of called The Zombies. And I always thought The Zombies records were fantastically well produced. That's why I went to them to produce Everyone's Gone to the Moon. So Ken, who was the main producer, had booked session musicians. And they all turned up, and we were talking earlier about great session drummers. Clem Cattini was one of the finest. But one of the other great session drummers was a completely barking mad, balmy lunatic, who I loved and still do, called Ginger Baker, who went on to be in Cream and other bands and was always a brilliant drummer. By the way, the guy who played acoustic guitar and Everyone's Gone to the Moon was a session player called Jimmy Page, who went on to bigger things himself. As well. So Ginger Baker turns up for the session, and I look at him in horror, and his foot is completely bandaged and in plaster. And I said, Ginger, what happened to your foot? He said, oh, I broke it, I'm afraid. And I said, but that's the foot you've got to be, you've got to have your bass drum pedal you'll be pedaling on. And I was the most producer, the producer most addicted to the bass drum in my music of any other than Steve Barry, who we mentioned earlier. And if you listen to some of those Mama Cass and Grassroots singles, you'll hear that bass drum come thudding through. And I owe that to Steve Barry, who is a very odd man and a terrific producer, somebody who's very underrated and not as known as many others. But I said, Ginger, you can't possibly play the drum. Your foot won't even fit on the pedal. Don't worry, Jonathan, he said, I shall kick the bass drum. I said, Ginger, are you out of your mind? He said, no, I'll do it. So we make the record, which I'm glad you like, because I think it's a superb version. I think it's the best version of the song, apart from Dylan's, and actually I think it's about as good as Dylan's. And I don't really say that about many of my songs. From this interview, it sounds like I say it about all of my songs, but I really don't. Very few of them, to me, have worked as well as the original, but that was one that did. And at the end of the session, I went down to thank everybody, and say particularly thanks to Ginger, and his entire foot, from the ankle down, was scarlet with blood. Ginger Baker gave blood to make my record.
Amazing. Jonathan King, we're going to hear that record now. Thanks so much for visiting with us this morning. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, we'll talk again. Thank you.
Just like a little girl. Queen Mary, she's my friend. Yes, I believe I'll go see her again. Nobody has to guess that baby can't be blessed till she makes love just like a woman. Yes, she does, and she aches just like a woman. Oh, but she breaks just like a little girl.